Gospel according to Matthew. We come to a strange little section of Matthew. It's not mentioned in Mark's Gospel or Luke's or John's. It's just here. It's verses 24 to 27, the end of chapter 17. So listen as we read this together, please. When they had come to Capernaum, those who received the temple tax came to Peter and said, "Does your teacher not pay the temple tax?" He said, "Yes." And when he had come into the house, Jesus anticipated him, saying, "What do you think, Simon? From whom do the kings of the earth take customs or taxes? From their sons or from strangers?" Peter said to him, "From strangers." Jesus said to him, "Then the sons are free. Nevertheless, lest we offend them, go to the sea, cast in a hook, and take the fish that comes up first. And when you have opened its mouth, you will find a piece of money. Take that and give it to them for me and you." In short, Jesus does not have to pay the temple tax, but he does. That way of approaching life is the way that Jesus taught his followers to use. Let me just say something about what's happened in this country in the last 40, 45 years. We'll just focus on marriage. Last 40, 45 years, there's been a great deal of attention in thinking and writing and living out marriages where each partner is quite clear as to what his rights are and what the fair balance of work is and what justice requires in the marriage. And I read an interesting little... Do you know, I read the advice columns in the Inquirer. It's not the source of the wisdom I try to live by, but it gives me a sense of, okay, what is mainline sort of secular advice like at this point in our society? So I read the advice, not every day, but I read them. So this is a question on marriage. And the answer was a chastened modern answer. Yes, marriages should be fair and equal. But it turns out trying to live it that way doesn't produce happy marriages. Interesting. So, you'll be happier if you focus on what you can bring to the marriage than on what's your fair share. How many of you think that's a good answer? I think that's a good answer. That was a great answer. Now, the Bible says there's a place for individual rights. There's a place for charity. Paul, at one point, stood on his right as a Roman citizen. "Is it lawful for you to scourge me, a Roman citizen, uncondemned?" All right, that was the right time and place to assert his rights as a Roman citizen. But by and large, Jesus' approach is to say, although justice in human relations certainly has its place, we should make our rule more one of charity than one of justice. Another way to say this is, the second great commandment is to love our neighbor as ourselves, and it isn't to say, the second great commandment is to make sure I get a fair deal. Now, this is a tough message for Americans because it's built into the American DNA that we will fight for our rights, we will defend our rights, we will stand up as individuals, and we will not take guff from anybody. I've long thought that the real slogan of this country was the slogan, I think, of the Vermont flag at the Revolutionary times with a snake on the flag, and the logo was "Don't tread on me." And I've long thought that captures the American frontier spirit and the American Yankee spirit, and the American Confederate spirit, and pretty well captures this country. It doesn't capture the gospel, however. And Christians in this country are tempted to, of course, coalesce the two. So look at this passage here, and we'll see why Jesus pays what he doesn't have to pay. They came to Capernaum. Capernaum was the town that Jesus made his headquarters when he preached in Galilee, which was a good part of his public ministry. It's a large town on the north shore of the Sea of Galilee. And probably, almost certainly, Peter had a house there, and Jesus would have stayed in Peter's house. They come back from their trip north. Remember, they traveled up north to Caesarea Philippi, out of Jewish territory into Gentile territory. They came back. They came back with a wiser and shaken group of disciples. Wiser, Peter had said, "You are the Messiah." And Jesus had said, "You are right." Chastened and worried and unsettled. And the Messiah is going to go to Jerusalem and be rejected and be put to death and raised on the third day. And they hadn't wanted to hear it. Peter didn't want to hear it. And on the Mount of Transfiguration, Peter, James, and John had gotten one message from God. And that was, listen to him. Especially about what? Well, about what was going to happen in Jerusalem. He spoke with Moses and Elijah. Luke says it was about his coming exodus or decease or leaving in Jerusalem, his coming death. So they come back to Capernaum. They would have loved to start shouting, "Jesus is the Messiah." But now they didn't quite know what that would mean. And Jesus had told them, "You're not to tell anybody." And they kept quiet. They shortly have arrived, and somebody representing the temple comes to Peter with, have you noticed this is a challenging put somebody on the spot question? Does your teacher not pay the temple tax? Maybe you've faced those questions sometimes. Somebody just purposely putting you on the spot. And Peter has to answer yes or no. Now they come to Peter because Peter is it's his house. But everybody understands it's the teacher, it's Jesus who's calling the shots as to what they would do. And you should know that the temple tax was controversial. Can you think of a tax that's not controversial? The temple tax was, according to the Sadducees, a Pharisaic invention of the previous, 250 years, so it was recent. So the Sadducees said no such thing exists. Other Jews said you should only pay it once a lifetime. But the dominant view was, as a matter of patriotic and religious duty, you should pay the temple tax. Now, how much was the temple tax? In your translations, I suspect there's a little footnote by temple tax. And maybe there is or not. At the bottom, does it say 2 drachma at the bottom? I don't have that. No footnote. All right, there should be. The Greek doesn't say temple tax at all. The Greek says, "Does your master pay the 2 drachma? And the 2 drachma was the precise amount of the temple tax. So that became just a way of saying the temple tax. The 2 drachma tax amounted to a flat tax, same amount for every person, of about 1% of their annual income. It was 2 days' wages, 1 drachma being the standard one. What should we get for 1 day of work? So 2 days' wages, we are 200 days a year. Basically, a 1% flat tax. In Pennsylvania, by comparison, what's the flat tax in Pennsylvania? 3% and a weird decimal. All right. If you live in Philadelphia, the flat tax is higher. Does your teacher not pay the temple tax? It was controversial. Now, why would they be asking that about Jesus? Jesus and the temple. I don't know whether that resonates with you, but that was the charge they brought against Jesus when they arrested him some months later in Jerusalem, that he was against the temple. Why would they say that? Well, early in his ministry, before these events, and John records it, and late in his ministry, as recorded in Matthew, Mark, and Luke, Jesus had gone into the temple and he had thrown over the money changers' tables. He kicked the animals out of the court and then he held forth there in the temple. Do you know why there were money changers in the temple? It was because you had to pay the temple tax in a certain particular coin. And people from all over the empire coming with different currencies would come there. They would, for a suitable price, change in their euros and get the appropriate amount, or change in their yen and get the appropriate amount in the kind of currency that the temple said you had to be paid in. So that was the temple tax. And if Jesus was already known for having thrown over the money changers' tables, it's not an unreasonable question, was he against the tax which the money changers facilitated people paying? Not only that, Jesus had said some startling things. Destroy this temple and in 3 days I will raise it up. Are you sensitive to how sensitive the Jews were to the words of destroy this temple? Nebuchadnezzar had destroyed the temple. It was rebuilt. This is the second temple. But for Jews to hear the words destroy this temple is... I was trying to think what's the equivalent to destroy this temple for an American. I think it would be to take a copy of the Declaration of Independence, a copy of the Constitution, wrap them up in the American flag, and burn them. That's about how insulting you could possibly be. So Jesus had said, destroy this temple, and in 3 days I will raise it up. Now John says he was talking about his body, not the temple. But the Jews could be forgiven for not getting it as Jesus said it. He had said to the Pharisees one time, and this is in Matthew chapter 12, verse 6. This was an argument about the Sabbath. He said, yet I say to you that in this place there is one greater than the temple. The Jews of Jesus' day could hardly imagine something greater than the temple. Not just because it was large, glorious, and just impressive to look at it. Remember, his disciples were so impressed by it that after they went out of the city and they sat on the Mount of Olives and looked back in the city as they're on their way to Bethany, they just exclaimed over it, Master, isn't this a magnificent temple? And Jesus' response was, oh, don't be impressed, it'll be gone soon. So, it's not an unreasonable question. And the representatives of the temple scattered throughout Israel for people they thought might not be going to Passover and paying the yearly tax would try to collect it in Galilee and in Perea and the other provinces. So they came to Jesus. Does your teacher not pay the temple tax? Now, Peter's answer is, as we would say today, rather defensive. Peter was a loyal Jew. He was an observant Jew. You remember he said when he had the vision of the animals let down from heaven, I have never, never tasted unclean food. All right. Peter is not from the tax collector part of the population. He is an observant Jew, and he is a loyal Jew, and he is a patriotic Jew, and I suspect it never in his life slipped Peter to pay the temple tax. So they come to Peter. Does your teacher not pay the temple tax? And Peter answers very quickly, yes, he does. He pays it. Now, Peter didn't know that, did he? But Peter couldn't imagine that he didn't pay the temple tax. Peter comes inside the house. Jesus, fully aware of the conversation, doesn't matter whether he just overheard it or whether he knew it as... how he knew so many things. Peter comes into the house and Jesus talks to Peter. He says, Peter, let me ask you a question. What do you think? The kings of the earth, who do they take taxes from? Sons or from strangers? Now, we need to adjust our thinking as Americans. In our view, if the president were to say to his relatives, listen, you don't pay tax because you're my relatives. We would be upset with the president. If you're a Republican, it would be a big media issue. If you were a Democrat, we would just hear about it on Fox. But we would hear about it. All right. And some people would be upset either way. But in the ancient world, and in a large part of the world, the American outlook seems really daft. Why would you tax your own relatives? I discovered this was the Middle Eastern attitude when I was there towards what we call nepotism. Their view was, if you won't take care of your relatives, how could anybody trust you? Not unreasonable. In this country, nepotism, of course, has a bad name. So in the Roman world, the Caesars were not taxing their relatives. I can tell you that. You tax the countries you conquered. That's what you conquered them for, so you can tax them. Actually, in ancient Israel, it worked the same way. They taxed Moab, they taxed Edom, they taxed Ammon, they taxed Syria. You can call it what you want, tribute and gifts and whatever, it's a tax. And so all through the Roman Empire, there are tax collectors getting taxed from everybody. And the Romans who'd done the conquering, especially the relatives of the emperor, they don't pay the tax. That's sensible. Why do you tax your own relatives? By the way, if you were in charge of everything in, say, Pennsylvania, would you tax your relatives? I won't ask. Of course you would. Of course you would. You're Americans. That's how we think things should be done. But Jesus' question assumes a whole different outlook. So Peter answers. He knows the answer to the question. He says, essentially, well, he doesn't quite say that's a stupid question, but he answers very quickly. Well, you take the tax from strangers. You don't take the tax from your sons, from your relatives. So Jesus says, well, that means the sons are free, doesn't it? There's a piece of the Old Testament where Saul wants somebody to kill Goliath for him. Do you remember all the promises he makes? All right, if you kill Goliath, you will marry the king's daughter. You remember that piece? There's another piece that maybe we just kind of don't pick up on. Your father's family will be free of taxation in Israel. That's another piece. You just grant somebody amnesty from taxation because they've done some service to the state. And who's done more service to the state than your family, if you were in charge? So, Peter says, from strangers, of course, not from sons. So, Jesus said, the sons are free. And then comes a surprise. Nevertheless. Now, what does he mean by the sons are free? Who's the son? Jesus is. When all the way back when he's a 12-year-old, he goes to the temple and he stays behind, and his mother and father go off for a whole day, and by today's standards are guilty of horrible child neglect because they haven't kept track of Jesus for a whole day. And at the end of the day, they think they should find out where Jesus is, and he's not among the relatives, and he's not in the crowd. And so they go back to Jerusalem, and they hunt around the city, and finally they find him. And by the time they find him, his mother and father are really irritated with him. And Mary says to him, "What do you think you're doing?" Jesus answers and says, "Didn't you know I must be about my Father's business?" Jesus all the time spoke in a clear and unique way that God in heaven is his Father. Now, to whom does the temple belong? Well, it belongs to his Father in heaven. The temple is God's temple. So, how in the world could you imagine that the Son of God would go to the temple that belongs to God and pay tax? In the ancient world, just an impossible situation. Not at all plausible. So, the sons are free. Jesus here is claiming, I have no moral obligation. I have no legal obligation to pay that tax. And then comes verse 27. Nevertheless, lest we offend them, Peter, go to the sea, cast in a hook, take the fish that comes up first. When you've opened its mouth, you'll find a piece of money. It doesn't say a piece of money in the Greek. It actually says a Greek word that stands for 4 drachmas. Enough for Peter and Jesus. You'll get a piece of money, just the right size, right amount. And you take it and you pay for you and for me. And the temple tax has been paid. Now, why does Jesus pay the temple tax? It's not because, and here again we went over this a couple of weeks ago. It's not because that he's afraid of hurting the feelings of people, nor is he afraid of offending them that they get angry at him. You see lots of times in Jesus' ministry, he is not afraid of having people get angry at him. The word behind here, and there's no good, I've tried to think of a good English translation because all the translations aren't satisfactory. And I can't think of any good English way to translate it. Lest we offend them means lest we put a stumbling block in their way so it is difficult and hard for them to believe me and trust me and listen to my preaching. That's what he means. It is for the sake of all of those who might listen to Jesus, but would be so outraged to hear that he didn't pay the temple tax, that he's going to go ahead and pay it. And now you get back to where I began. You see, he's going to act on the principle of charity, not the principle of rights. And this is way outside his family. This is in the society in general. He is going to do what will make it not hard for people to listen to him and believe in him. He has no duty to do so. He has no moral reason he has to do by a legal kind of thing. It's the second commandment, the second great commandment reason. You shall love your neighbor as yourself. And if you love your neighbor, you want your neighbor to believe in God, in this case Jesus, to listen to him, to trust him, to hear him, and to follow him. And if he were to refuse to pay the temple tax, people would have a reason they could throw up so that they wouldn't even, oh, you can't even listen to this guy. He doesn't pay the temple tax. He's not a good Jew. Was there anything wrong with paying the temple tax? No. Nothing wrong with paying the temple tax. Now, when people hear that we should live more looking out for the welfare of others than looking out for our own rights, I think the reaction of lots of people in this country and probably around the world is, this sounds both unfair and hard and like a burden. Is it? Well, one of the things Jesus said that we take on faith and then we try to live out on faith is this. Jesus said that his burden is easy and his yoke is light. That is, living the way he taught us how to live, following him in our lives, will turn out to be a burden and a yoke, but light, compared to living any other way. Now, in this story, how does the burden turn out not to be heavy? Well, in a unique way. He tells Peter, here's how we'll pay the tax. Go fishing. The first fish you catch will have the coin in its mouth that you need. And you go pay the temple tax for me and you. And then nobody will have reason to be offended in us. And it won't have been a great burden on us to pay. I think you've heard this from me before. It is sometimes just disappointing and worse to read some of the commentaries on the books of the Bible. You know, if you go into a study and you see, say you go into Zach's study, because I try to get rid of a lot of books recently. Say you go into Zach's study, right, and you see the shelf and you have commentary on Matthew. Book 1, book 2, book 3, book 4, book 5, right? I hope you're impressed and you're glad somebody's reading them all. But there's some really dumb things in some of those commentaries. Really dumb things. And it's right here. I ran into a couple of really dumb things. First dumb thing. Matthew doesn't say that Peter actually did go fishing and catch the fish. So it didn't happen. That doesn't follow, does it? Actually, that's just a clever way of saying how poor we are. That we don't have enough money to come up even with a 1% flat tax. It was just a figure of speech. Now, what's wrong with that explanation? Well, you still had to pay the temple tax. So if they're actually that poor, then they can't pay it. What's the point of making that point? I don't understand why as many commentators are taking pains to say Peter actually didn't catch that fish and pay the temple tax. I think the clear, obvious intent of Matthew's account is this was the end of the story. Peter, of course, would obey Jesus, would go out there right by the sea, throw in his hook, pick up the fish. There are ancient stories of actually things like this happening with fish. The Greeks liked them. Americans like them, too. And make a nice, interesting story on the page 3 of the Inquirer. Fisherman finds gold coin in fish's mouth. That'd be fun. So the Greeks like those stories. And nothing impossible about this. So I've always assumed that, like the we have at home a game that I brought out the other night. I haven't played for years, called Bible Authors. It turns out not to be mostly authors, it's just Bible characters, but the game is called Bible Authors. And Peter is one of the characters, and one of the clues is he found money in a fish's mouth. And I think that game has it better than a lot of the commentaries. All right, where does that leave us? Well, it leaves us with another example in the Scriptures of how to live. And it's all the way through Jesus' teaching. We need to resist insisting that because American public and political life rests solidly on the principle of individual rights, that's the way to live everywhere. It doesn't make for happy families. It doesn't make for happy churches. It doesn't make for happy workplaces. It just doesn't make for happy. Why? Well, it's not God's way. That way always ends up putting me first, not my neighbor first. There's one thing that our congregation does. We're sort of unusual on this. We have a legal right in this country, and I think it's a good arrangement, that we don't pay taxes on church property. But this congregation does pay taxes on the parsonage. You might notice that in our annual treasurer's report. Why? Well, years ago when they built the parsonage, that would be about 1956, what they said is the people they said in the congregation, they said, look, we live in this country. If we want the police, we expect them to show up. If we want the firemen, we expect them to show up. And so it's right that we should pay taxes on the parsonage where our pastor lives, so we'll pay taxes. So we do. We don't have to. We could appeal it, and I'm pretty certain we would get out of paying it. I think we act, if not on a principle of charity, at least on a principle of not just trying to get all we can for ourselves, but a principle of generosity. Christians and our relations with outsiders, not just inside the church and not just inside our families, also need to follow the path of charity more often than we follow the path of rights. And that's one of the points of this passage right here. That's what Jesus does and tells Peter, that's why we're paying the tax. Not because I have to, but so as not to put barriers in other people's way for their belief.